You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been nearly 2 years since Albanian immigrant Ded Rangsbajai and his wife Flora took refuge at Central United Methodist Church in downtown Detroit. She has multiple sclerosis. He is her sole caregiver. And he'd been allowed to stay in this country on humanitarian grounds. But then his deportation order came down, and that is when the couple sought sanctuary at the church. We spoke with them in April 2018.
All my choice is gone, and no other choice.
For me, to help me for all my life, and help me every day to take a shower, to change clothes, for everything, help me. I'm needed for all my life, my husband.
Let's explore the history of sanctuary churches in Michigan and how the sanctuary movement is responding to the tougher stance on immigration under President Trump. Here now is the Reverend Jill Hart Zundel, who's pastor of Central United Methodist Church in Detroit, and University of Detroit Mercy History Professor Roy Finkenbein, who is an expert in the Civil War era and the Underground Railroad.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Reverend Jill, I want to start with you and tell us, how are Ded and Flora doing? Because they're closing in on 2 years since they sought sanctuary at your church.
Correct. And they're getting more and more frustrated. We had a court date with a federal court judge asking simply for the judge to remove the label fugitive from Ded so that the merits of the case could be looked at, because ICE refuses to look at it. They've labeled him a fugitive. So we waited 10 months for a response from the judge, and she basically said, I can't decide this in my court. You need to go to the Federal Court of Appeals. So we filed with the Federal Court of Appeals. And so that is another, we're told, 9 months of waiting. So I was concerned about telling Ded and Flora that. I think that they had given up hope. And when I went up to have that serious conversation, they really looked at me and said, okay, this is a new fight. This is something we have to do. So I was surprised by that conversation, but they're willing to continue to fight to stay together as a family.
And they have, since they sought sanctuary at your church January of 2018, they have not dared step outside?
Flora can leave the building.
Yes.
Because she has a humanitarian stay. Ded has not left the building. He'll, step outside in the parking lot occasionally, especially when the Democratic debates were going on downtown. He was looking around and what was going on. But no, he doesn't leave. We have, if he has any medical issues, we have a doctor that comes in and sees him. We have a dentist in the congregation that comes in and sees him.
Has ICE ever tried to enter the church?
They have not come into the building. They have driven through the parking lot. But they have not tried to come into the building. They said that they would honor that.
All right. And what about the level of commitment and support from your parishioners? I mean, what does it take in terms of money and resources and volunteer hours?
It takes a lot of money because it's a family of four. And the main breadwinner, Ded, cannot leave and cannot have a job. So we do fundraisers. And we have different people that drive Flora to the doctor. We have their youngest son is in high school in Southgate. So we have volunteers that drive him to school and pick him up from school. So there's a lot that goes into it. We have support systems from a Jewish temple and from other congregations who also come and help out in different ways. And then we have a Friday night soccer group that comes and plays soccer with Ded on the fifth floor. He used to be a semi-professional soccer player, and that helps with his stress.
So this is, it's ecumenical, and it seems as though your congregation's support is unwavering.
It's interesting. We had a miscommunication one Sunday when, after Donald Trump announced that he was going to raid places, I had told my building superintendent, please let me know if ICE comes in the building. And in the middle of my sermon, he said, Reverend Jill, ICE is in the building. And I looked at the congregation and I said, start praying. And I went outside and it was a Detroit cop who was looking for something completely different. But when I came back into the sanctuary, everyone had surrounded Ded or they had their cell phones ready to film it. So it was almost like a drill getting us ready in case that happened.
So, Roy, you've studied this, the sanctuary movement. Actually, we're going way, way back in history, aren't we, for the origins of the sanctuary movement?
Well, the Underground Railroad really is a product of the late 18th and early 19th century, depending on whether you're in the East or the Midwest. And, you know, certain aspects of society became particularly involved, families, but especially particular churches. You know, many Quaker groups, anti-slavery Presbyterians, anti-slavery Methodists in the North, so-called come-outer denominations, which were smaller groups that came out of larger denominations over the issue of slavery, the Wesleyan Church, for example, and a host of others, the Francian Synod from the Lutheran Church, and many others, and also the black churches, the African Methodist Episcopal and Black Baptist churches, especially heavily involved. And we had that in Detroit. I mean, the Bethel AME, Second Baptist, St. Matthew's Episcopal, all of those were very, very involved. First Congregational certainly has that history, St. John Lutheran and others. And so, the churches took on that role. It was not as public as, for instance, today's sanctuary movement where churches identify.
Different era?
A different era, and it depended on the time and place where you were. These were communities that oftentimes, particularly if you're on the north side of the Ohio River, were very divided. And there was a lot of everything from social ostracism to violence that could result. And you didn't know if local authorities would honor,
the way they are now.
Sanctuary, the way they are now. And also there was you wanted to keep the secret so there was the possibility of movement, because the Underground Railroad ultimately had the goal of getting people further north, including to Canada. Mm-hmm. So you wanted to keep the secret for purposes of movement.
So we would not have had Reverend Jill on talking to the state of Michigan on Stateside talking about that. But did things pretty much work the way that Reverend Jill's describing?
Yeah, providing people with all the basic necessities of life, food, clothing, medical care, but in this case, and transportation elsewhere. Yeah.
And then didn't our country also, I see a surge in the sanctuary movement in the 1980s as people were fleeing a violence and civil war in Central America?
That was huge. That's where you see, I think, a lot of the first use of the term and the organization from church to church and denomination to denomination with the notion of sanctuary. And, some of the churches, for instance, there's a Presbyterian church in Tucson that's one of the national leaders dating back to the 1980s with this. And they very clearly make the connection very openly to the idea of the Underground Railroad.
When just touching on the Underground Railroad, for typically how long would people stay? I mean, here we are looking at nearly 2 years and the prospect of the better part of another year while this court fight draws on. What was it like in the Underground Railroad?
Typically, you wanted to move people on fairly quickly. It was slowed down by need for rest, need for, whatever the elements were, need for medical care, those kinds of things. If there was pressure from slave catchers, bounty hunters, authorities, et cetera, looking for people in the community, that could slow it down. So all of those things, but there's a premium on moving people on as quickly as possible. It could take days to get to Canada, for instance, if that was the goal. It could take weeks. It really was situational. I had the opportunity to write an op-ed earlier in the year on improvisation in the Underground Railroad. And the point being, we tend to think because of that term railroad.
Yes.
That, like Mussolini, the trains ran on time. And in fact, people had to be very, very improvisational. And if I have time for a story, there's actually a ancestor of one of my uncles, and he left some of these details in his personal papers, but it was a Quaker couple, Obadiah and Sarah Williams from Hardin County, Ohio, and after they got married in 1845, very, very active in the Underground Railroad. And there's one incident where they're hosting a family of freedom seekers in their home. They just served them breakfast, and two slave catchers came in on horseback into the barnyard. And Obadiah immediately goes out and under the guise of being a good host, helps them water and rest their horses. Sarah is busily cleaning up the breakfast table, hiding the family elsewhere in the house. And then when the slave catchers come in, cooking them a second breakfast, but listening very carefully to what they're saying about where they're going to look for people. As soon as they leave to look for the freedom seekers that they think have gone on, she hitches up the horses and wagon, takes them further to another safe house. That evening, the slave catchers come back to their house very disappointed. They haven't found this family. So this Quaker couple puts them up for the slave catchers up for the night in the room that the slaves had had stayed in the night before.
That is courageous. Reverend Jill, you're able to speak publicly. I don't think you need to worry about quite that, but that reaction that everybody had when they thought ICE was coming in of your congregation, people were prepared to to do what it takes. And here you are carrying the torch and this tradition. What dangers do immigrants, because you're not the only church doing this in Michigan, the story's being repeated around the state.
Correct.
What dangers are they facing?
They're facing different things. It depends on where they're coming from, right? So Ded and Flora are coming from Albania, where it was under communist rule when they left. And they talk about only having bread to eat. And how they were forced into the army and those kind of things. It depends, you know, in Guatemala, there's drug trafficking. There's also climate change that causing people to flee their country. So it depends upon the country. It depends upon we did have another family that was not a public sanctuary a year before, and they had come into the country from Africa who were seeking asylum from political unrest in their country. So there are public sanctuaries, but there are also a lot of private sanctuaries going on as well that people just aren't aware of
right now.
So
we really don't have an accurate count as to how many churches are providing sanctuary. There's the public, but as you say, many private. And does it cut across denominations and religions? Are you seeing other congregations, other religious, other faith groups?
Yeah, we're talking Muslim groups, we're talking Jewish people, we're talking across the Christian denominational lines, point to all different kinds of churches who are willing to step up and you know, save people, basically.
If you've just joined us, we're talking about sanctuary churches in Michigan, their history, and the way they are active today, as we talk with the Reverend Jill Hart Zundel, who's pastor of Central United Methodist Church in downtown Detroit. That's where an Albanian couple has sought refuge since January of 2018, so we're going on nearly 2 years. And talking with University of Detroit Mercy history professor Roy Finkenbein, who is a specialist in the Underground Railroad. Roy, there is that quote, "Those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it." What has our country forgotten, and what are we repeating now?
Well, one of the things that if I can kind of speak in a large vein, we tend to forget every few generations of the important small L liberal traditions that we have, reformers trying to improve the lot of citizens and reformers trying to make this a welcoming place for immigrants of all stripes. Mm-hmm. And we can be misled by people of a particular political stripe very easily, demagogues and others, and we see it again and again. You know, current situation with the Kurds in Syria, someone used the language today, we haven't seen this kind of behavior from the State Department since McCarthy. Mm. Of course, that was the 1950s, and we see every few generations some of these things just keep recycling. But I think that the tradition of America is one where we historically point to positive change in the past and forget that there are contemporary analogies that if we looked at them square in the eye, we'd understand that some of the things we're doing today are deviating from the things we celebrate in the past.
Mm-hmm. What do you want to add to that, Jill?
I'm trying to think. I mean, when you're talking about repeating history, right? So I was training to be a docent at the Holocaust Center in the early 90s. And I was shadowing a docent. And there were a bunch of businessmen. And they asked the question, where were the churches when this was going on? And the docent looked at me, knowing that I was a pastor, and looked at me and said, "Where were the churches, Jill?" And from that moment, I said, "Never again, not on my watch." Mm-hmm. And so that's my motivation for doing this. And I would hope that other faith leaders would remember that moment when we didn't speak up, that now is the moment to do that.
Why does this matter in Michigan in 2019?
I think it's insane that in Michigan, we who, you know, the Detroit police won't cooperate with ICE. Wayne County sheriffs won't cooperate with ICE. I'm trying to get the mayor to say Detroit is a sanctuary city, but it's insane that we are hiding people, that are just trying to make a living, that have not broken the law except for being undocumented, and want to just to make a better life for their family. And now he can't even do that. He's locked up in a church without the ability to provide for his family.
What kind of solution is this? I mean, it's one way to recognize and combat the immigration policies of the United States, but not a solution.
It's not a long-term solution, but it's a necessary and urgent solution for those individuals who are being, you know, impacted by this. And, you know, it's the moral equivalent of seeing a starving man on the sidewalk and giving him a crust of bread. In the long run, you want to see some social changes that means that he won't be hungry long term. But in the short run, you can't forego the fact he needs the crust of bread.
Right. And I you know, that's why public sanctuary is so important, because private sanctuary, nobody knows. And in public sanctuary, media gets a hold of that story. People hear the story. They realize immigration is not a black and white issue. They join with us. We had over 1,000 letters of support written to ICE, which were ignored. We have walked to Lansing. We've had people walk with us 90 miles to Lansing to talk to congresspeople and senators about what's going on. And I think that that's part of a public sanctuary movement is engaging other people in this fight too, not just keeping them safe, but trying to change the systems of why they had to move into the church in the first place.
Are you getting people lending you an ear? People in power?
A few. I get very frustrated because I've talked to a few congresspeople who tell me, well, we'll write a letter. And I said, that's not going to do anything. However, I also recognize they don't have any power in this fight, because ICE only answers to the Attorney General, who only answers to the President. So no matter what pressure they put on, there will be no change until there's a change in administration. So there used to be congresspeople could do a private bill on a specific person, and that has been changed. So they're no longer able to do that either.
So what do you think will be the reality eventually, when there is somebody different in the White House and a new administration? I mean, has the China been shattered, or do you think we'll be able to go back to a policy that does not have a couple like Dad and Flora living in your church for nearly 2 years?
Well, I think we need to change that policy, but also the other. Dad does not have a path to citizenship right now. So immigration reform is of the utmost importance. It's not just a change of administration. It's a change of law.
Reverend Jill Hart Zundel is pastor of Central United Methodist Church in downtown Detroit, and University of Detroit Mercy History Professor Roy Finkenbein, who's also co-chair of UDM's History Department. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us.
Thank you.